Hello, friends. This is the second hour of Out of This World Radio, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here in Bellevue, Washington, 1150 AM. The program focuses on out-of-this-world information, including psychic phenomena, UFOs, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. We will have only the best psychics and UFO people in the world on our program, and I guarantee, my friends, it'll be the most interesting radio program you've ever listened to, as you will hear information here that you will simply not hear elsewhere. We are also one of the top-rated talk show programs in Seattle, and we are also the fastest-growing UFO and psychic program in the world, with listeners in over 60 countries. And today I started the second hour with a little bit from Star Trek because we have Lynn Kasdan on. He's on the phone now, and we'll be interviewing him in just a minute. But Lynn has written incredibly interesting books, including his most recent book called Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Whereas Star Trek was fiction, what Lynn has to say in the next hour is not fiction, and it's the real deal. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
Oh, good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, good, good. Well, just a quick introduction. Lynn's website is www.et-secrethistory.com. Lynn's a UFO researcher and a freelance writer. He's intensively studied the Edgar Cayce readings at the ARE Institute in Virginia Beach and has been a lifelong devotee of astrology and theosophy. He's a former member of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon and the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, and he is the president of the American Philosopher Society. He's been a feature writer with more than 50 published articles for Atlantis Rising magazine. He lives in Casa Grande, Arizona. His books include The Secret History of Extraterrestrials and The Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Today's interview will focus on both of his books and his wonderful information, with particular emphasis on his most recent book, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. And Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ted. Nice to be here.
Well, it's so good to have you on today. You know, you have an important message to tell the world, and I've read your book, and it's just incredibly interesting. Could you tell us a little bit how you got interested in UFOs and ETs, Lynn?
Well, I had an experience while I was in the Air Force that evidently got buried in my subconscious and got me interested. I think I was taken on board a craft, but I haven't been hypnotized to actually validate that. But as the years go by, I'm becoming more and more convinced that's what happened because of the circumstances of the what happened.
Oh, interesting.
So, That's the first thing that happened, and then at that point I didn't know anything about UFOs. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was I found myself joining NICAP inexplicably a couple of years later, and then I was joining MUFON, and then I realized that I really was into it, and I never connected it with that incident, though, that happened in the Air Force, but evidently there was a connection.
Okay, are you there, Lynn?
Yes, I am.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Good. The other thing I was going to ask, too, is how did you get started on this second book? I remember you mentioned before about a website, www.serpo.com.
Well, I was in the habit of attending the annual UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada for years. I think I went to that conference for about 15 years while it was going, and then it was only recently that it discontinued. But it has been resumed, by the way, this year. And at that Congress, just about everybody interested in UFOs would come from all over the world. I met Jim Ryan there in 2005, and I was on the same shuttle from Laughlin to Las Vegas to get to the airport. And in that 2.5 hours, he was talking about the Serpo story. And, of course, at that time was hot off the press. He was one of the few people that knew anything about it. And I just listened to him and discussed it with him for that whole period of time. And by the time we got to Las Vegas, I was hooked. I had to know more about it.
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, in the preface of your book on page 2, you write about there was an interstellar space program, an exchange program, if you will, between our astronauts and Planet Serpo, in which 12 U.S. military personnel left this planet Earth, in 1965, in which it was called Project Crystal Knight, a.k.a. Project Serpo. And they were scheduled for 10 years, is that right? But it actually took them 13?
They were scheduled to be there for 10 years, but they lost track of time. All their timepieces stopped working. And Serpo had two suns in the sky and longer days and a different kind of orbital revolution. So they lost track of time. And once that happened, they really didn't know. They had to go ahead with Serpo time. And that stretched out to 13 years instead of 10.
Interesting. All right. Now, a bit of history. You mentioned in your book that as early as 1933, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt met with the Pleiadians. There's a story on the USS Missouri in 1933. Do you know much about that? That was in a footnote.
Yeah, that's the story that Al Bielek told.
Mm.
I think you know who Al Bielek is, don't you?
Sure. Yeah, he had connections with Montauk
and the Philadelphia Experiment.
Sure.
That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And Al was pretty reliable, and I came to believe that everything he said was pretty... And it did make sense because Roosevelt started preparing for World War II at just about that time.
Mm-hmm.
He started changing over industry and getting industry ready and making plans, started the Civil Conservation Corps, so he had a lot of young men who were in good shape and ready to join the Army. In other words, he was making plans long before anything came up, that even before Hitler came to power, or just about the same time that Hitler came to power, which was 1933. So I think it all had to do with that meeting that he had on board the Missouri.
There was another rumor that I've read about, Lynn, that I wanted to share with you, that... President Eisenhower did, in fact, meet with aliens in about that 33-34 time frame, but it was instead at the Panama Canal with a different group. I don't know if you've heard that rumor as well. I've heard several things going around, but...
Well, I don't know how old Eisenhower was in 1933, but he couldn't have been very old. I don't know if he was even in... He might have been even in West Point at that point, wasn't he?
I think that's the year, 33-34, when he first assumed a presidency after... In the early 30s, from my memory, I'd have to go.
No. Eisenhower didn't become president.
No, I'm not talking Eisenhower. I'm talking about President Roosevelt back then.
Roosevelt, yeah, 32.
Yeah, 32. So,
right.
I meant to say President Roosevelt, not Eisenhower.
Yeah, and then he was reelected in 36 and 40, and then again in 44.
Right. Now, as a backdrop to this, you go in your book, and it's a fascinating account of the Nazi and German activity in Antarctica back in the 20s, 30s, and the 40s. And they called it New Schwabenland, something like that.
New
Schwabenland. And there was a gentleman named Hanshofer, a German scientist, a military tactician, who became very interested in this, and he was key and instrumental in both... helping Hitler rise to power and also a proponent of building a Nazi base in Antarctica. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Haushofer didn't really have anything to do with the Antarctic adventure, as far as I know.
Okay.
He used to meet with Hitler in his cell at Lansdowne Prison when Hitler was imprisoned for the push in Munich, and he helped him write Mein Kampf. Haushofer had been in the Green Dragon Society in Japan. He was one of few Westerners to ever reach that, to receive that honor.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is that he came to Germany. He came back to Germany. When he came back to Germany, he had the express intent of finding the savior of the German people and trying to take over the Russian heartland. Mm-hmm. And... that was his goal, I believe, and that's what I put in the book. So he had a lot to do. He started the Thule Society, he started the Real Society, and by the time he heard Hitler's first speech and realized that he was the one he was looking for, both of those organizations were running, and they both helped to get Hitler elected to the presidency in 1933, because most of the important businessmen in Germany were members of that society, the Thule Society.
Now, one interesting thing you said on page 17, that you made an interesting statement that fascism mirrored the hive mentality of the gray reptilians. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, in studying what happened in World War II, I realized that the reason that fascism took root so easily in Japan was because the Japanese people were all of the same ethnic background. So it was an easy thing to establish because all they needed was one leader, which was the emperor, and the rest sort of followed as a sort of a hive mentality. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that Hitler tried to do the same thing in Germany, mm-hmm. he tried to get a pure race in Germany,
right.
for the same reason, he being the dictator, because that was sort of the alien way. The aliens, especially the Greys, did have a hive mentality. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a strange thing, and to me it indicated that I was right in believing that the aliens were really behind the fascist movement. And I'm still convinced of that.
Interesting, and I agree with you, too. I think that certainly the gray aliens, reptilians, influenced Hitler to do the horrific acts he did and World War II. The other thing, too, is that you go into a fascinating account of the roots of the Nazis and how they gained this super advanced technology from the grays and the reptilians.
Yeah, particularly the reptilians, right. Yeah.
Right, right. And you talked about a bell-shaped craft called the
Honobu,
right. And on page 23 of your book, you mentioned the Honobu 4, in which case there was a joint German-Japanese crew on a mission to Mars, and they left Germany, I guess, roughly in 1945, just before the end of the war. And the crew,
yes.
You've written, crash-landed in Mars in January of 1946.
Right. And of course, by that time, Hitler was dead, supposedly.
Sure.
It was really characterized as a suicide mission. They knew in advance that they probably would not come back. Once they crash-landed on Mars, they were not able to revive the engines and head back. Hmm. And even if they had, they would have found the world very different from the one they left.
Oh yeah, I bet. Well, for my readers, following page 186, there is a actual picture of this craft, which is amazing. Where did this come from, anyway? That's a picture of
this.
You
know, I'm not sure of the origins. There are some websites out there that have a lot of these photos out there.
Right.
Some of them are by German people, and in any case, it definitely appears to be a photograph and not an illustration.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think it's the real thing.
Yeah,
and that's why we published it.
Yeah, it looks like the real deal. Now, during the late 30s, there were numerous German expeditions to Antarctica, and people don't realize this, but at the end of the war, there were 54 U-boats missing, between 142,000 to 250,000 people missing from the entire SS Nazi technical session. There were also 6,000 scientists and tens of thousands of slave laborers missing, as well as approximately 10,000 women missing from the Ukraine, which Himmler called them the Arctic settlement women, Antarktische Siedlungsfrauen.
Could you
explain?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that what this means is that that these people were taken down to Antarctica to create a new Nazi base. And could you explain a little bit about that from what you know? I know we've written about it in your book.
I think it was the result of the connection with the reptilians because my belief is that the reptilians already had a base under the ice there.
Mm-hmm.
And since Hitler had already made a deal with them, they were involved in World War II, it was their idea. And that colony in Antarctica was strictly a scientific base. It was never intended to be a resettlement area for the German population, mm-hmm. in the event they lost the war, mm-hmm. because at the time they settled that base in 1938, Hitler was very confident of winning the war, so he wouldn't have put an escape plan like that in place. It was a deal. It was an underground, under the ice colony with only the purest Aryans were meant to settle, and all the scientists and all who had created the flying saucers, they were the ones that went down there.
Well,
he was more or less left the rest of the population of Germany to die in the invasion.
Okay.
They were going to start a new, pure Aryan race And that so-called lost division of German soldiers, or the Wehrmacht, they never showed up, so they were probably there too. About 150,000 soldiers.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And the women, the 10,000 women were meant to start this new pure race with the veterans of the Russian front, the Waffen-SS, soldiers, at the ratio of 4 women to each man. And Hitler's plan, or Himmler's plan, was to create literally a pure Aryan race there in Antarctica. Now, the reason I included that chapter was because at the end of that chapter, you read, I'm sure, that we sent a convoy down there called Operation High Jump.
Right.
But when we discovered the German colony there.
Right.
And there were 13 ships, including an aircraft carrier, and it was headed up by Admiral Richard Byrd. And the purpose of that was to destroy the Nazi base. And Byrd himself said that the purposes of that convoy, that expedition, were military. Mm-hmm. He said that before they even left.
Sure.
So it was never a scientific expedition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, they were...
Are you there? Are you there, Lynn? Well, friends, we'll get him back here. Just give us a minute. We're having a little trouble today. We tried to reach him on Skype and couldn't get through. But according to Lynn's book, just a fascinating book, that Admiral Byrd actually had gone down there in 1947 to confront the Nazis and try to eliminate this base. And I think the problem, and I know Lynn will probably have some interesting things to talk about that, is that the technology possessed by the Nazis at this secret base in Antarctica were far superior than anything that we had to fight them back. So we pretty much, after that, left them alone. An interesting question I would love to ask Lynn when he gets on the air in a few minutes is what's happened to this base and whether it's still there. From his book, that he's inferred that the Nazis have used their technology that they've gotten from these greys and reptilians to go to the moon and also Mars as well. So I think it's just a fascinating account he's written. The other thing that that I'll be asking him about is the interchange with Kennedy. Apparently, according to in Lynn's book, he writes on page 86 that President John F. Kennedy made a directive for an exchange program with these aliens in September 1962. And as a result of that directive, that in 1964, there was an actual meeting with them, and the aliens had given our government what's called the Yellow Book. Now, the Yellow Book is about, from what Len has written, it's about 2.5 inches thick. And it's not a regular book. Like you find in our culture. Instead, when you open it up, there's all kinds of holographic images, and when you open it up to a page, for example, you'll see it's like watching a movie of past Earth events and events in our universe, and I do want to ask about that. The other parts of his book, he gets into cloning, how they clone individuals in their society, and there's kind of a dark side to them as well. There's actually two different groups who visit this planet Earth. One's called the Galactic Alliance, and the second group is called the what I call the Greys and Reptilians. The Greys and Reptilians are a negatively based alien civilization, and this is a story about that our involvement with them since the 1920s and 30s. Lynn, are you there?
Yes, I am. Uh-huh.
Oh, wonderful. I'm sorry we lost you there, my friend, but thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. I almost thought I'd lost you at the beginning of the program, but I'm glad you're back.
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, good, good. Anyway, all of these U-boats were missing. You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people were missing, and during the war too, the World War II, the Allied. I remember reading in your book that the Allied command in 1943 had seen a lot of German U-boat activity in the South Atlantic,
right,
raising their own suspicions about what was going on. I have to ask you this. There's so many questions I want to ask, Lynn, but is that base still there today? Do you know? Do you think it's still there?
As far as I know, it is.
Okay.
As far as I know, we did send a a flight. We did send some planes down there in 1958, and they, I think, emitted a electromagnetic pulse that could penetrate the ice and the ground, and I think that was an attempt to destroy it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they succeeded.
All right. And using this technology they've gotten from the reptilians and the grays, do you think they've gone to the moon and Mars and other planets in our solar system?
Who?
The Nazis? From this base?
I think that was the intent of the base. The base was to be an interplanetary base from the South Pole.
Okay.
Whether they actually got there, I don't know. I doubt it.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
Sure.
I don't know.
Sure. It's hard to know what the truth is. The other interesting thing, too, you've listed their alphabet on page 66, which I thought was really interesting. It looks like scribbles to me, but what do I know? It's interesting, though. You've listed their alphabet from the aliens. On page 86, you mentioned that Kennedy had issued a directive for an exchange program in September of 1962. Could you tell my many listeners a little bit about that?
Well, the suggestion for the exchange program originated from the captured alien that we had from the Roswell crash in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
We had learned how to use the communications device that was on the Roswell craft.
Mm-hmm.
And the alien that survived that crash lived until 1952. Just towards the end of his life, we discovered a way to get that thing working.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent 6 messages to his home planet, one of which was a suggestion for an exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when that suggestion was first made, and he wouldn't have made it unless probably Eisenhower had okayed it.
Sure, sure.
In any case, by the time Kennedy got into office, they were ready for that, and Kennedy approved the exchange program when he found out about it. Hmm. He was briefed on it.
Fascinating.
And he said, go ahead with it.
Now, the other thing you mentioned in your book, and this is all fascinating, I'm sure, to my many listeners, Lynn, is that on page 110 of your book, you talk about a 1964 meeting in which the aliens gave our government what's called the Yellow Book. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, we call them the Ebens. We named them the Ebens, which was a very unimaginative derivation from extraterrestrial biological entity.
Mm-hmm.
Their first landing was in April of 1964.
Hmm.
That was the arrangement.
Okay.
And at that landing, they were supposed to take our 12 people on board and take them back to their planet. However, when they got here, they changed that and said they would rather wait a year and come back and get them in 1965. But at that meeting, at that landing in 1964, that was more or less of a ceremonial meeting, and they presented us with something called the Yellow Book, which was a very incredible device that could access remote histories, remote periods of history, and pictures would appear, words would appear in the language that the reader was conversant with. And our people who have tried to read that book have claimed that it's a book they just could never finish.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that started it said he was reading it for 22 days, and he still couldn't get anywhere near the end of it.
Wow.
So it's, I'm sure, under lock and key at Bowling Air Force Base, and that was their gift to us.
Well,
when they first landed,
I have to ask you a couple of hard questions. And that the first hard question: if that was a gift to us, who's us? Was that to the power elites on this planet? Was it for the masses of people, for everyone on Earth, or just a certain few? I have to ask that.
Their arrangement was with our government.
Okay.
And the exchange program was with our government.
Okay.
However, following that first contact in 1964, and then they did come back in 1965, they have been back 8 times since then.
Okay.
Hmm. And we have established a diplomatic relationship with them.
Oh. Well, I'm sure glad to know about that. I'm sure... this is news to me, and I'm sure for most of my listeners around the world, we're all kind of astounded. It would have been nice if our government had been open about this. I know President...
That's what I wanted to say.
Hello, Lynn? Are you there? We lost Len again. We'll try to get him back in a minute. But I know that President Kennedy was all in favor of an open society. He actually had made a quote about that. And if I can find it here, I'll read it to everyone. But the other thing, too, is that this society was 240 trillion miles away from here. So it was an amazing that we had this exchange with them, and they're still here, and nobody knows a thing about it. I've been told by my other guests on the program, including Scott Lemriel, that in Area 51, there's actually Area 52, Area 53, and Area 54 down in the same area in Nevada where Area 51 is, and that's a gray reptilian space base right there. We built it. The taxpayers in the United States paid for it, but do we ever know about it? Are there any escorted tours? We're not allowed there. We're kept strictly off limits. If we try to get in, they'll shoot us. And so there's a lot of things that go on in the outside of this planet and on this planet that we're just not simply being told about. But I'm so glad Len's on today. Len, are you there? Here, we'll get you back on. Len, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, fine, my friend. I'm so glad you came back.
What I wanted to explain about that landing at Johnston Island was that we invited the Soviet Union representatives, the People's Republic of China, and the Vatican to that meeting. So we opened it up. We voluntarily opened it up to other countries.
So it's not a surprise then that Russia, China, and the Vatican, and probably all the other countries in the world know about this now. It's just a shame that most people, I think, on this planet have no idea this is going on. Absolutely clueless. Absolutely clueless. Now, just want to take a quick station break. For those who just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States in North America. And we're having a fascinating, truly out-of-this-world interview today with Len Kasten, the author of his fascinating book, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo, a New York Times bestseller. The other thing, too, is now there's a lot here, but basically you wrote about how this planet that our astronauts went to in 1965, that planet basically is a police state where everything is tightly, very, very controlled. And they actually have a little device they wear on their waist, a small device which controls their actions and thoughts. Could you explain that a little bit about? Because that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's a very highly regimented society we discovered, and like 1984, and they all wore a little device on their belt, which today we wouldn't be so surprised at because it's probably like a smartphone, and that told them more or less what to do and when to do it, and they would do things on a very precise schedule based on a tower, like a sundial tower, that every time it changed, they would then change and go to a different activity, and it was universal. It was throughout the planet, so it was even though they all were very smart, and we discovered that their average IQ was about 160, which was put them in the genius category, all of them. But nevertheless, they were highly regimented because evidently the elite who ran the show had everything under control.
Fascinating. I have to ask you a whole bunch of other questions regarding this because our government's been in collaboration with them now since the 60s. And I've had another UFO person on my show named Scott Lemriel. He's written an interesting book called The Sayres Agenda. And in that book, he has been told by the Galactic Alliance that the same technology that you describe in the book from this planetary civilization, which is used to control all the individual actions of these people on this planet, is also being used in a detrimental way on this planet as well to control many of our own leaders. Scott writes about that in his book. It's a conjecture on my part, but that's my belief from what you told about this.
Well, frankly, I don't think they need it here because they've got television.
Oh.
Okay. We've got television, so I think that does the job.
All right. Well, that's funny. The other thing, too, is that I don't want to get too far off on a tangent on this, but as many people may know, there's a big chemical trail chemical program here in the United States and other countries where various governments are spraying chemicals into the atmosphere, and one of them is sulfur. I know that because I used to live in eastern Washington in a little town called Moses Lake, Washington. And there this summer, I saw U.S. Navy planes coming over my house and other places in the area spraying tons of sulfur every 3 days. And it didn't make any – logically, it didn't make any sense, Lynn, because at that time there were tremendous forest fires going on in the east part of the Cascades. And why would they ever dump all this sulfur, especially when it would make it a lot hotter? Now, in eastern Washington, where I was living this summer, in the Columbia Basin and the Moses Lake area, temperatures ranged between 100 to 120 degrees on a daily basis. It never got cooler than 100 degrees for 6 solid weeks. I had friends who had heat stroke. I got heat exhaustion, almost got heat stroke one day, just from the heat. You'd step outside, it's 118, 120 degrees, you almost drop. And logically, Lynn, you have to ask yourself, why is our government, with our tax dollars, dumping all this sulfur and all these other chemicals on us? For what reason? And the reason that I think it comes to is that some other UFO people have speculated that the military in this country and many of our leaders, I won't mention any names, are controlled by these gray reptilians. And they're terraforming the planet, and they're terraforming the planet by dumping all these chemicals on us. And that's the only thing I can think of, because on page 138 of your book, you mentioned the temperature on this planet as being over 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And
right.
if you're a gray or reptilian-based species, you like it hot. I never forget I've been down in Arizona before, Lynn, and you know the rattlesnakes down there and the lizards. They love it when it's warm, but early in the morning, if it's a cold, cooler day, they don't really start moving around until it warms up in the afternoon.
Right.
And I've been told before that they like hot temperatures, so it would make sense from their perspective to have our controlled military, controlled by them, to spray all this crap in our atmosphere so it makes it much hotter.
But I have to correct something. The Ebens on Serpo.
Uh-huh.
We're not the same species as the grays.
Okay, that's
fine. There are different species, and that point was made clearly by the website.
Okay,
they look different, and they have no sinister intent. They are our friends. So the grays may be responsible for that, but the upper quadrant on Serpo was very cool and moderate. And ultimately, our whole team went up there to live, and they built a community for them there. And that climate was just like Montana.
Oh, okay.
It was virtually the same as Montana. So it's a different story. The grays may also thrive in hot weather, and the reptilians as well. I'm not sure, but nevertheless, the Ebens are a different species entirely.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you you explaining that, because I was just I saw a lot of parallels with that. The other thing, too, I wanted to bring up is that the Eben Society is basically a military-industrial oligarchy with an elite controller and the masses who are manipulated and kept in the dark. And the other quote that you had is that they're really not free. There's no such thing as individual liberty. They don't have any artistic or creative abilities, and that everything is very, very tightly controlled. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Lynn? I'm just interested in what your comments are on that.
Well, that's what our team discovered, and the commander wrote about that in his diary. They were highly regimented, and the only people that seemed to know anything were the elite scientists. We had to ultimately talk to one of the doctors who was in that category about why they kept the body of the dead American who died en route.
Sure.
He told them that they had cloned that body.
Okay.
And, of course, the commander was furious, and that almost led to a confrontation with them. But the point was that until the commander got angry and said he wanted to meet with this guy, they had never met anybody in that elite part of the country, of the planet. So there was a very definite chasm between the people and the elite. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's not uncommon on many planets. I don't know. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
It's actually developing on this planet, so we shouldn't be too surprised.
Right. I guess that's what's troubling about it, is that here's an example of a highly advanced technological civilization, but it's basically run, as you said, as a military-industrial oligarchy in which the masses are completely manipulated and there's only the elite. In the previous hour to having you come on the air today, Len, I had a gentleman named David Icke, and he talked at length about how the masses are controlled in this planet by the media and by the government as well. And and reading your book, it brought chills up my spine, down my spine, because I thought, oh, my goodness, I think, Len, that the future of humanity is extremely bright. And I know that we will evolve into a wonderful, we are powerful spiritual beings, and we have a wonderful future ahead of us. But of course, we have to deal with this stuff now. It's troubling that this society that you said was basically a police state, basically a 1984 kind of society.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. I think our future is a great one and a glorious one, because I think that the potential of the human race is way beyond anything we can imagine at this point. And once we get past this sinister conspiracy situation, I think we're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree with Nostradamus back in the 15th, 16th centuries, Lynn, when he said that beginning in the 2030s and 2040s, and I think it's starting even earlier now, that this entire planet, the people here will embark on a thousand-year journey of a wonderful spiritual evolution and a true golden age. And I think that's certainly starting. I work with the Emoto Peace Project, for example, in Tokyo, Japan, and they do wonderful work in helping people, teach them the value of love and gratitude to make this planet a better place. And I think that they're on the cutting edge of creating a better planet for all of us. My radio station is the purpose of it is to raise consciousness to let people know in a good, positive way that our future is indeed very, very bright. And I have
I'd like to talk to you more about that later. That's interesting. Very, very interesting. I know some people in Japan, and that is fascinating.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Lynn. Well, Dr. Emoto was a wonderful man. He passed away last month, an untimely death. But his work goes on. They have a wonderful new director of the Emoto Peace Project named Michiko Hayashi. She's coming to a conference I'm having here in Gig Harbor, Washington, from March 6th through the 8th, 2015. It's called the Galactic Wisdom Conference. The website is www.galacticwisdomconference.com. And let's talk about this off air, but we could squeeze you in. I'd love to have you participate in some way, Lynn. That would be fun.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in that. Now, a Japanese journalist living here in Tucson has just sent my book to her contact in Tokyo. She claims that there's going to be a lot of interest in this book in Tokyo. So I'm waiting to hear the results of that.
Oh, fascinating! Fascinating.
She feels it could be a television program there.
Oh, fascinating! How fascinating! I have to tell you a couple things I read in the book, and I wanted to run it by you. That there's a dark side of this Eben planet. That they do a lot of cloning, and that that our astronauts who were there went into a laboratory once and saw hideous looking creatures, including one entity. It looked like a human, but it had the head of a dog. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, the commander was absolutely revolted by what he saw. He told them he wanted to see the body of 308. 308 was the American who died on the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took the body. He didn't know what happened to it. He said he wanted the body. He said the body belonged to us, not to them. And that led to a confrontation. Eventually, he was able to speak to the doctor in charge, and he took him on a tour of their biotechnology laboratory, and he saw what he considered hideous creatures, all kinds of combinations, and his remark was in his diary was, "I have seen the dark side of this civilization." However, to them, it was not something evil. It was strictly science. At that time, in 1965, we didn't know very much about DNA. So he couldn't relate it. And the scientists on the team, we did send two scientists along with the team. They didn't know DNA either. So they didn't know what they were doing. But these Ebens have traveled all over the galaxy. And wherever they go, they bring back biological samples, and they use them in their experiments. Mm. And they don't consider it anything evil. They just consider it science.
Mm-hmm.
But to him, he said, I have seen the dark side of this civilization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, now we may be doing the same thing. Who knows?
Well, I know that the agreement that President Eisenhower signed with the gray reptilians in approximately 1954, it might have been 53, I'm not sure the date exactly, but it was around 1954, specified that in exchange for some of their technology that this government, the United States government, would allow them to abduct humans to, quote, study us. And since that time, according to other things I've read, they've created a hybrid of reptilian gray human entities, and they've also created devices which are attempting to control our free will, including many of our leaders and corporations around this planet.
I covered that subject in my first book.
Oh, okay.
The subject of the hybrid project. They are creating a hybrid race. They have already created thousands, perhaps billions, of the hybrids.
Right.
And Spielberg took that on in his TV series called Taken in the early 21st century. Mm-hmm. I think it was 2003. The hybrid project is now well known.
Yeah.
It's no longer a secret. That's what they do. That's what they're doing when they abduct Earthlings.
Yeah.
They're creating a hybrid race.
Forcibly without our consent.
Well, was it without our consent? I'm not sure. That agreement with Eisenhower may have taken that in.
Yeah. Well, I don't think what they're doing is right personally, and that's just my own opinion. But you do have a fascinating, if I recommend everyone to get a copy of Lynn's book, it's a fascinating book. He has an image on plate 16. It's a photograph of a, it says image of a human alien hybrid girl. And I know my listeners can't see it, but I'll just describe it for you. She's got blonde hair. Her eyes are very big, almost black. The pupils are almost gone. It's just very, very black. Her face, her chin is pointed as if she's a gray alien. And she looks human, but if you look at her carefully, you can see where she's got some gray reptilian characteristics.
And she's got very large eyes.
Very large eyes. The other thing too that's just fascinating, you have on plate 23 a picture of the Egyptian god Anubis, and you've asked the picture itself is fascinating because it's it looks human from the shoulders down. It's all human, but from the neck up, there's actually a it looks like a dog. Do you think they were operating back then to create different strange, grotesque creatures back then?
I think so. I don't know. It's well known that there was a lot of that going on in ancient Egypt. In fact, mm-hmm. I think Edgar Cayce talked about that in some of his readings, if I'm not mistaken. So where that came from, I don't know. Was it extraterrestrial? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was definitely an extraterrestrial influence in the building of the pyramids. So my guess is that was going on, and they were creating those creatures. They must have known about DNA in some way, shape, or form. And I think you get a better view of that by talking to some of the ancient alien people, like George Tsoukalos. He might know more about that than I do.
Sure. Well, there's so many trends that your book can certainly go into. The other interesting point is that here we sent space missions to the moon in the late 60s. Of course, in 1969 we landed on the moon, and then our last time, if my memory serves me correctly, was 1972. And then I've heard this persistent rumor for decades that we were ordered off the planet and not to return. And it's funny, it's always a logical inconsistency to me that if we spent all this money and resources to get to the moon, then Lynn, suddenly we're not going there anymore, allegedly. And then I've heard also that we have actually a covert, we have two space programs in this country, in the United States. One's a covert space program and then an overt space program. The overt space program, which is NASA, but unfortunately their budget's been cut so much it's down to kind of a meaningless exercise in space shuttles. And I'm not even sure whether that's going up now. But the covert space program is supposedly operated out of just outside Denver, where they supposedly secretly train astronauts using captured ET technology to fly spacecraft to the moon and Mars and other parts of the solar system, but they're limited to this solar system. They can't go beyond this solar system. Have you heard much about that?
Yeah. Bob Dean talked about that at length. Do you know Bob Dean? Have you heard about Bob?
I think this is probably the information that's coming from him, but I didn't connect the name.
No, others have talked about it. We according to Bob, we do have something called the Space Command, mm-hmm. the U.S. Space Command, and it is headquartered outside of Denver somewhere, out of, or Boulder, I'm not sure where.
Right.
But I think it's operated out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California.
Okay.
And we do have a military space station in orbit, as well as the civilian one, the international one. And I don't know whether you've heard about that hacking incident where Gary McClintock, was that his name?
I think so.
Who hacked into NASA and discovered that we had spacecraft talking to each other already, just like in Star Trek. So it's going on. There is an overt and a covert space program. I agree with you entirely.
Well, there was a quote that you had. I was looking for it earlier from President Kennedy, a very good quote. I really liked President Kennedy, by the way. I think he was one of our best presidents. But at any rate, he had made a statement about the need for openness in society. And it's just such a shame, really, that all this stuff's going on. And most people in the United States and certainly the world have no idea this is going on. And this is why your book is so important. Here's the quote I'd like to read for everybody. And in a speech on April, and you mentioned this on your book on page 89, you write, in a speech on April 27, 1961, before the American Newspaper Publishers Association, President Kennedy said, quote, "The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are as a people inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweigh the dangers which are cited to justify it." And wasn't there another quote from, it was either from Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, and they had written way back 200 years ago that a society that trades security for
openness, yeah, exactly.
For freedom deserves neither.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was Franklin who said that.
Franklin, right. And I think his words are as true back in 1776 as they are today, friends.
Yeah, and by the way, Kennedy's the entire speech is available on the internet. I think it's on YouTube.
Oh, wonderful.
This whole speech was remarkable. And that's probably the best quote from the speech, but it was to an audience of journalists that he made that point and he made that speech.
There is another quote, and I talked about that this summer when I had Dr. Michael Sala from Hawaii. I'm sure you know about him.
Yeah, I do. I wrote an article about Dr. Sala, yes, in my first book.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I can't wait to get it. When I get it, Lynn, and read it, I'd love to have you back on, and we could talk
sure,
about
it. Sure,
about
absolutely.
That.
I'd love to.
Sure.
I'd love to.
Well, there was a...
Sala is the one that came up with the term exopolitics.
Right. Great man. I really like his work. He's a wonderful researcher. He had sent me, he was on my show here a couple of months ago this past summer, Lynn, and one of his very interesting quotes in the book he had was a 1961 quote from official an official memo from MJ-12, which is Majestic 12. It's a secret UFO group, which I think is still in existence today. And it said roughly, I can't remember the exact wording, but it said something like, when conditions become difficult, and it was written in coded language, but it said something to the effect that if a U.S. president does not go along with what we want, then it's time to eliminate him. Now, that's not the exact quote, but it was written in coded language, and that's the implication of it. I think that President Kennedy was, in fact, eliminated because he wanted to expose the UFO information from the CIA and other parts of our government, and there were forces, unfortunately, that didn't want that disclosure to happen. I think that the United States and the world would have been a lot better off with that disclosure. And I think that the secrecy that we have today in many sectors of the world in our government is stemming from that historical bent on secrecy for decades. But this is another track, Lynn. This is why your work is so important to tell people, and the reason why they should get a copy of your book, Secret a Journey to Planet Serpo. Lynn, go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead with the question. I'm sorry.
What other kinds of projects or books are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on one now related to the abduction phenomenon and the hybrid project. That's going to be my next book.
Okay. Okay. Interesting.
There's a lot to that has not been been revealed yet. The Whitley Strieber story, for instance, has to be explored in more detail. There's a lot to the abduction story that needs to be explored. I think Dr. Mack's book and David Jacobs' book were both helpful.
Great guy.
And Bud Hopkins also. But oh, yeah. more needs to be said about that.
I had David Jacobs on my program a couple of months ago, and really enjoyed talking to him. He's done so much interesting work, and you know he's an academician. He's retired now.
He was an associate professor at I don't remember which college, but
Temple.
I do know you. Oh, Temple. That's
I think
right,
at
yeah.
Temple. Yeah, he was at Temple, Ken and Lynn. And the thing is that he told me. I think we discussed this on the air, but I asked him. I said, "Well, many of your many people in academia, unfortunately, are very conservative. And when you make UFOs your main focus in abductions, how do they look at you?" And he said, "Well, I did a lot of good work, but I could only rise so far in the academic ladder because there was like a glass ceiling that I couldn't rise above that."
Yeah, and that's what happened to Dr. Mack too. They tried to get him. They tried to have him eliminated at Harvard.
Yeah,
and when they read his book, yes, but he survived that.
Yeah,
and but he didn't survive an early death, however.
Yeah, that's too bad. That's too bad. Well, I just want to mention we've got about 2 minutes left, Lynn, and I just want to mention to my many, many listeners around the world that 1 week from today, we will have the rest of our interview with David Icke on for the first hour, and I guarantee it will be truly out of this world.
Absolutely. Yeah, David Icke's great. He's really good.
good. And we've got about a minute and a half, Lynn, left. Lynn, and I'd like to give you the floor, and please wrap up with anything you'd like to say.
Well, I think that if anybody that buys my book should read Appendix Number 12, because Appendix Number 12 is a complete disclosure by MJ-12 of the entire story. This is the revelation we've been waiting for, and there it is in black and white. Unfortunately, it's buried as an appendix in that book. But if somebody will read that, they will realize that everything they've suspected is absolutely true.
Lynn, in the minute left, let me just read a quick excerpt of this since it's so important. Number one, this is a MJ-12 staff document issued on July 30th, 1999. It states, 1, intelligent life does exist on other planets and throughout the universe. 2, craft not of human design or manufacture are operating in and around land, sea, and air of Earth. 3, intelligent beings other than Homo sapiens are conducting various missions on this planet. 4, they may have human-like bodies or non-human bodies. 5, the variety of life in the universe is diverse, like the life on our planet is diverse. This is fascinating. Number 6, some alien beings have the ability to move forward in time and be able to time travel. It's fascinating, just fascinating. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on today, my friend, and let's talk off air about coming to the conference next year.